Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. For the past several days, a malicious ransomware attack has wreaked havoc around the world. Among other things, the attack has crippled the National Health Service, hospitals in England, a telecom company in Spain, and infected hundreds of thousands of computers in more than 150 countries. Joining us now for the latest in this story is security reporter for Wired, Lily Hay Newman. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get started, I want to ask you just to give us the primer on ransomware. But is this hit the United States? Has this hit the United States?
It has to a certain degree. There was some spread in North America. But by the time the ransomware was getting here, it was kind of slowed by a few different factors. So the impact wasn't nearly as large in the U.S. than it was in Europe and Asia.
Now, for that primer on ransomware, what is it? How does it work?
The basic setup with standard ransomware is just that malware infects the computer such that it can encrypt all the files on the hard drive, and then a screen comes up that says, like, oh, shoot, you've been, you know, hit with ransomware, and you're going to have to pay a ransom to get the decryption key to get your files back. So the idea is, you know, standard mitigations for that is something like having a backup ready either in the cloud or on an external hard drive so that you don't have to pay the ransom and you can just backup, you know, reload from your backup and move on.
This ransomware is called WannaCry, as in I want to cry over this. Can you tell us, when I was just listening to it until I read about it, I thought, WannaCry, what language is that? Anyways, can you tell us about this attack? What distinguishes it?
It is a pretty typical form of ransomware. There isn't a ton that makes it super sophisticated or unique, but it does incorporate an exploit that allows it to spread through networks that have other vulnerable devices in sort of a worm-like way. So it has some extra, you know, attack power because of that. And that exploit that it is using, or the vulnerability that it's exploiting, sort of indirectly came from NSA spy tools and was picked up by criminals through a leak. So that's a component of the ransomware that is noteworthy.
And there's indications that the perpetrators behind WannaCry aren't necessarily very sophisticated, that the breadth of this attack is an indication of that.
Yeah, there are kind of a lot of different signals at this point about what might be going on. A lot of evidence indicates there are a lot of mistakes in the ransomware. There, you know, it doesn't seem to be super sophisticated. It seems a bit cobbled together. So a lot of evidence points to it being sort of random, you know, criminals, maybe just a third-party group messing around. But then there are also some indications through doing code comparison that perhaps the malware or the ransomware has links to North Korea and North Korean state-sponsored hackers. So that's not a conclusive tie at this point, but there are a lot of sort of different avenues that digital forensic analysts are pursuing to try to figure out where it came from.
Is there any way to show where it kind of started, where the first hit occurred?
I think in terms of timing, you know, the first hits seem to have been in Europe, in the UK, and in Spain. But in terms of tracing back to, you know, the servers that it originated from or who the attackers are, that process is still ongoing.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Wired security reporter Lily Hay Newman. She's written recently about the WannaCry ransomware attack. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, this ransomware targets a flaw in Microsoft computers. What has Microsoft said about this?
Right. So it is a Windows flaw, Windows Server bug. Microsoft had already released a patch for it about 2 months ago. So they were, you know, already going about their standard, you know, approach to hearing about a vulnerability and then patching it. Mm-hmm. Once all of this started happening, because clearly adoption of their patch hadn't been high enough, you know, this ransomware was still able to exploit the vulnerability on many systems. Then they actually took the unusual step of issuing an additional patch for computers and servers running Windows XP, which is an old version of Windows that probably everyone is familiar with, but that's no longer supported by Microsoft because it's so old. Mm-hmm. So normally they would not release a patch because they aren't supporting it. But in this case, the situation was so dire that they rushed to get a patch out that, you know, people running Windows XP can download. So they took a lot of steps and really hustled to try to do everything they could to, you know, address the problem.
Back when they issued that first patch, you said obviously not enough people, not enough institutions employed the patch. How do you know when you're getting a patch? Does Microsoft tell you, put this in or you're vulnerable?
Yeah, I mean, certainly Windows in, you know, all the recent iterations, even back to XP, has mm-hmm. mechanisms for informing people of when patches are ready to download. Microsoft also releases patches on a pretty consistent schedule. So if you're the IT, you know, manager or system administrator of a large organization or institution, you're certainly, and, you know, you're running Windows systems, you certainly are aware of how Microsoft releases their patches. But there are challenges to implementing patches, especially for systems that are always on, you know, need to always be running. It can be difficult to have the time or the resources to actually apply patches. So, you know, there's reasons that people don't always do it, but on the flip side, it's just really crucial, and this whole incident has shown that.
Alex in Columbus, you're on the air with Wired's Lily Hay Newman. Hi, Alex.
Hi there, Ann and Lily. Hey,
hey.
Lily, I wanted to call and ask you, you said something about it slowing down once it arrived into America or coming in this direction. What exactly was that? And that's all I needed to know.
Okay. Why don't you tell us about that? I guess it was a cybersecurity researcher, right?
Yeah, so it wasn't so much that it was entering the U.S. in particular. It was just the timing. There were a couple of factors that slowed the spread. One was just as the situation came into focus and people started realizing what was going on, system administrators all over the world started scrambling to apply the patch, you know, so that their systems would be protected. So, you know, since the attack started in Europe and Asia, there was just a little bit of lead time for North America that allowed for more patching. But yes, the other component was that a researcher discovered a sort of kill switch in the ransomware that may or may not have been intended to function as a kill switch, but was basically a way that, you know, the researcher could register a particular domain name, a URL, and because the ransomware was checking to see if that domain was registered or not, doing that allowed the or sort of notified the ransomware that it should become inert, stop functioning, and that was another component that slowed the spread.
How easy is it to find the people behind these kinds of attacks?
Yeah, well, it's not very easy. It does depend, you know, sometimes people make mistakes that, you know, point to them very easily. It depends what their sophistication is in covering their tracks. But certainly one standard component of ransomware is to request your ransoms in Bitcoin mm-hmm. Or another cryptocurrency. And certainly the purpose of that is to make it more difficult to track. You know, you can see money going into the Bitcoin wallets, but actually finding the identity of the person behind those wallets is intentionally, you know, very difficult. So,
challenging. I heard that... The address of the Bitcoin wallet that they gave to the victims was the same across the board, which is an indication of the lack of sophistication, but also could help in tracking these folks down.
Yeah, I have heard about other wallets cropping up, but definitely it did seem like the setup was pretty sort of standard or rudimentary. But yeah, I mean, it depends how long it takes. And, you know, not sometimes law enforcement doesn't necessarily want to immediately reveal, you know, mm-hmm. their leads or their clues about who they think is behind it if they're trying to do an operation to get into their networks or to, you know, gather more evidence without the perpetrators knowing that they're onto them.
What is there any way to summarize the damage done in this case? Or I guess people, I don't know if it was you, but, you know, calling it the big one, it's the big one. What were the consequences for everybody out there?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's fair to say that it, you know, to this point is sort of the biggest ransomware spread, maybe mm-hmm. you could say, or sort of single incident or something like that. The impacts were really far-reaching and really demonstrated the concerns that the security community has been talking about for a while in terms of the ability of even pretty standard, you know, out-of-the-box malware to wreak havoc on a lot of different sectors, critical infrastructure, critical services like, you know, healthcare, hospitals, telecommunications, things we consider to be basic utilities. So, unfortunately, it's really a good example of the types of worst case scenarios that people have been talking about.
And by the way, you say you refer to it as out of the box malware. This is available to anyone who feels like going to the dark side of the internet, right?
Right. You know, things like this, you know, you can purchase on the dark web. You can sort of make little tweaks and modifications and then run with it.
And you mentioned earlier as well the difficulty for systems that can't be easily shut down because you kind of have to do that to install the fixes.
Right.
Hospitals are particularly vulnerable to this.
Yeah, definitely. One of the challenges of securing critical infrastructure or vital services like healthcare is the constant need. You know, there isn't a day where the hospital is just closed, you know, for maintenance and mm-hmm, repairs. Mm-hmm. So that is certainly a challenge for system administrators and, you know, heads of IT. But it is possible to work around it. It just requires real support from institutions and investment. So, you know, I think there's a lot of tension in organizations where at times where system administrators are saying, you know, we really need more resources, we need more support. And, you know, directors or, you know, people on the other side maybe don't quite understand that vital urgency. And they just say, I don't know, figure it out. You know, we're already giving you a lot of money or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they're not really understanding the long-term risk.
Now that this big one has happened once, I mean, more likely that it could happen again or less? Or what do you think, Lily?
Yeah, I don't really know. I think on the one hand, we'd like to think that, you know, I think we'd all like to think that this, having had this happen, it means that we're all going to learn from it and, you know, hustle harder to install patches and, you know, be more careful and things like that. But in reality, you know, it's sort of never quite finished. There's always more work to do to get people motivated to understand the long-term risks. So I think it'll help as a wake-up call, but I don't think, you know, it's the end of exposed infrastructure or, you know, potential for damage or harm.
Lily Hay-Newman, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We'll have a link to Lily Hay-Newman's article for Wired about this big malware attack. They pulled it off in several countries, 150 countries around the world. It's called WannaCry, and it's make a lot of people want to cry. We'll be right back with more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Technology in the classroom is almost standard these days, and that has created a huge opportunity for tech companies, among which Google is the leader. New York Times reporter Natasha Singer wrote about the domination of Google in the classroom for this weekend. And to read it, you can check it out on the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Natasha Singer, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
First of all, give us a thumbnail of what Google offers teachers and students in terms of apps and equipment in the typical American classroom.
Well, for, you know, regular American consumers, you'll recognize a lot of the tools. Google has an education suite that includes Gmail. It includes Google Docs, the collaborative writing program. It includes Google Calendar. So all of that will be familiar to us. But Google has also distinguished itself by developing school-specific products. And the most popular one right now is called Google Classroom, and it's an app that allows teachers to set up a virtual class online and stick all their students in it and then push a button and assign them all homework or give them a quiz or start an online class discussion and also go in there and see which kid did their homework and when and how long they spent on it. And so about 15 million kids in the U.S. are already using this program. It's only 2 years old and change.
It's only 2 years old and change?
Yeah, it was launched in August 2014.
So there aren't necessarily kids that have grown up with this, but they've certainly grown up with Google in their lives, unlike me.
Well, again, it's fascinating because you visit schools and, you know, I'm trying to say to them, to ninth graders or fifth graders, like, how do these Google tools change your schooling? And they look at you like you're a Martian because they've never seen Microsoft Word. They don't remember, like, emailing a PDF of a document. This is what they know. So for them, this is schooling. It hasn't changed their schooling. This is normal.
This is normal. How fierce is the competition for this kind of a market?
It is incredibly fierce because it's not actually about schools. Schools are where tech companies place their products in the hopes of getting students accustomed to their brands and turning those students into lifelong customers. It's like training wheels, right? You give a kid training wheels, they will graduate to a bike. You give a kid Gmail in school, they're going to graduate to consumer Gmail, or when they go into business, they're going to use Google's tools for business. And that's why the competition is so fierce.
How did Google become the leader? Was it Google Docs or what? What was the key?
It's fascinating, and it's a complicated set of factors. One is that the Google apps are free to schools. And you have cash-strapped public schools, and some of them, you know, like Chicago Public Schools was spending $2 million a year on Microsoft Exchange email and another email service, and they switched to Google, and they're saving $1.6 million a year. Mm-hmm. So the first reason is price. The second reason is that Google out-innovated Microsoft and Apple, both in terms of these products, but also in terms of their marketing approach, which was heavily teacher-focused. You know, and the third thing is these tools are easy to use. So if you're not a techie teacher and you use this Google Classroom, which is kind of like a portal to all of Google's other tools, and you've never used them before, it's really easy. And that makes it, you know, like if you can just take attendance online instantly and it saves you time, then it's going to free you up as a teacher to spend more time with students. It kind of makes sense why these tools are taking off.
So while Microsoft and Apple were out conquering the world, Google was digging in and creating customers in the second grade.
Well, you know, Microsoft and Apple were already in there, right? And, I mean, this goes back to the 1980s. Steve Jobs wanted to give an Apple IIe desktop, one desktop to every school in the country in the 80s, and he did it in California. And so this is not a new phenomena. And Apple's iPad has been very, very popular with schools, but it wasn't a device created for schools. It was a consumer device. And Microsoft's products were office, you know, software that they sold into schools. And so when Google came along and said, actually, we're going to make products just for schools, that was a huge advantage.
They're offering the free apps, but they're also getting data in return, right?
Well, the first thing they're getting is the potential for lifetime customers because more than half of U.S. public school students are already using these tools. So that's, you know, the long tail profit. Mm-hmm. In terms of data, that is something that has been raised as a concern because, you know, these tools are not just students' gateway to learning, right? It's the scaffolding on which they're building their schoolwork. Their documents and homework are in there. Their conversations with their teachers are in there. You know, if they're using Google Slides, which is like a PowerPoint presentation, it's in there. And so there have been questions from parents, from school tech administrators, from, you know, Senator Al Franken saying to Google, like, what are you doing with all this information? And Google has given general answers, one of which is that, you know, the information is only used to provide the services in schools. They have given, you know, there's a Google privacy notice online which tells the general categories of information they collect from student use of the education apps, like location information or data about how users used our service. But that's not very specific. And by not being specific, there's just this blank space in which all parents' worries go.
Yeah, right. You wrote that in the space of just 5 years, Google's helped upend the sales methods that companies use to place their products in the classrooms. What was their marketing strategy? How did they do this?
They did it both from a top-down and a bottom-up approach. So from the top-down, when they got, you know, they started in universities. So when they got the first huge university, which was Arizona State, to say they were going to stop using their internal email service, which was expensive to maintain, and switch to these Google free services for like 65,000 students, then Arizona State, you know, helped Google tell other schools how great these things were and how easy they were to use and how much money they were saving. And it caused this cascade where suddenly you saw these big state schools adopting Gmail and other Google tools. And then they went to the schools and did the same thing where they got Oregon, the state of Oregon, to approve Google tools for all Oregon public schools. And then you had Oregon administrators talking to public school administrators in other states saying, you know, if Oregon did it, your school can do it too. And then they got Chicago, the third largest district in the country, to switch to Google. And then Chicago administrators, you know, wrote blog posts for Google and went around telling other schools how great this was. And so that was the top-down thing. But then there was the bottom-up thing where teachers are naturally altruistic. They love to share. If they find something that works, they want to share with their colleagues. And so Google kind of capitalized on that and cultivated teachers who could share the word and set up systems for them to do so. And then in schools that weren't actually officially adopting Google tools yet, those teachers were enthusiastic and go to their administrators and say, hey, we need this. This is really great. And so they really created a kind of guerrilla marketing force to put upward pressure on the schools.
How much do they actually control now, do you know?
How much do they control of what?
Of the world. No, I guess of schools. I mean, do you have a sense about how many districts, how many colleges and universities and how many districts out there are using this?
I have been looking specifically at the, you know, K-12, the public school system.
Right.
So we know that half of the K-12 students are using Google's apps, and we know that
in the whole country.
In the whole country, 30 million out of 55 million kids, or more than 30 million, are using Google apps. And in terms of computers, you know, in like 22, Google has a very inexpensive, kind of pared down laptop called a Chromebook.
Yeah.
And it took off in schools. And in 2012, when Google began trying to get schools to use this device, less than 1% of the shipments of school laptops and other portable devices were these Chromebooks. And so that was nothing in 2012. And last year, those Chromebooks accounted for 58% of the laptops and other mobile devices shipped to U.S. schools.
Go ahead.
So more than half of apps and more than half of devices are Google.
And that's just now.
And that is last year.
Wow. Has Google been criticized for this program? But besides Microsoft and Apple.
No. I think what you have to look at it, I mean, like, if the big picture is you have one of the world's richest, most powerful tech companies going in the space of 5 years from being a non-significant player in schools to the dominant tech player in public schools. And it happens to be Google, but no matter which company that was, it would raise questions about what is this company getting out of our public schools and what are they giving back? And what are the values of Silicon Valley that Google is bringing with it? And how do those mesh, or what kind of clashes are there with the values of public schools, which are different? And because Google is the leader, they are the lightning rod for these questions.
In your article, you wrote about the conversion of the Chicago public schools. You mentioned that a little bit ago. Tell us what happened there. What was distinctive about that?
So it's such a fascinating story to me because we think about the tech industry in Silicon Valley having these values of being nimble and adapting, and we should all be nimble and adapt. But from the point of view of Chicago Public Schools and other large districts that were the first to go with Google, like, here's this giant company, but it's a startup in education, and it doesn't know how to operate in education, and it wants to operate like Google. And so, you know, Chicago Public Schools, as I said earlier, was trying to save money on their email, and they did a request for a proposal, and Google won. And then it came time to sign a contract, and Chicago Public Schools needed Google to agree to abide by a federal student privacy law. And Chicago Public Schools administrator said in the beginning, Google just wasn't prepared to do that. They were like, oh, you know, we have company policies. We'll just send them to you, right? And they sent them these links to these policies for the consumer apps. And Chicago Public Schools said, you know, actually, your policies are your policies, but we have a federal law that we have to uphold here. And they said, you know, you're sending us links to policies that could change at any time. And Google is a company that has, like, online click agreements, right? And so they were like, let's do it our way. And Chicago Public Schools was like, no, that's not how schools work, right? So eventually Google does agree to abide by this privacy law, and it's part of the standard agreement now for Google with schools as pertains to Google's education apps. But there are these moments of tension where you see Chicago Public Schools having to school Google on the values of a large urban public school district. And you see it also, you know, Google is used to beta testing things. They put up a public announcement, millions of consumers want to try this cool new thing, and that's what Google wanted to do in schools. They have this new app, it's unfinished, called Classroom. They put out a public call, 100,000 teachers said they wanted to test it, and they had direct communications with these teachers before they notified the school district. But there are administrators in school districts who are in charge of technology, and part of that is to make sure that they protect data security and privacy. And teachers were starting to use this Classroom app and put in students' names and use it with their students without the central people in charge of technology knowing. And Chicago said, we are not going to allow this because we don't know if your Classroom app works. We don't know if it abides by our rules. We don't know anything about this thing. So Chicago Public Schools said, we're going to run our own pilot test of this. And they did a year-long pilot, 275 teachers, several thousand students, and they found certain problems. There were certain things that the app didn't do that were required by their district, like with cyberbullying. Like, if a student said something offensive or threatening and a teacher deleted it in this Classroom app, the Chicago administrator said, in the beginning there was no archiving feature. But for legal reasons, Chicago Public Schools needed to archive that. If there were ever, you know, an inquiry, you needed to have the evidence, right? And so Chicago went back to Google and said, like, we need this archiving feature. We can't turn it on. And it took a long time, but eventually Google did turn it on. And Chicago then allowed the teachers to use this Classroom app. And Chicago Public School teachers made other suggestions that ended up in this Classroom app. And Chicago then became a kind of unofficial testing lab for Google and, you know, pilot tested other products. Beta tested other products. And it's really, really interesting because I spoke to the Google folks and they said, yes, you know, Chicago Public Schools is one of our toughest customers. And if we can get it to work in Chicago, you can basically get it to work anywhere because sometimes they have things they need that other folks don't. And but Google also has to make a decision, right? Because sometimes Chicago wants something that's a little bit obscure and it may not be worth doing that. But what you see is Chicago helped Google make this tool better for students and teachers everywhere.
Do Microsoft, Apple, or anyone else have a chance of getting a foothold the likes of Google's?
Wow, that's a great question. I think that what we've seen in the last couple of years is this knowledge and sense that they have to work much more closely with teachers and schools. And so, you know, we talked about these Google Chromebooks, which are these Google-powered laptops. And Google has a system that makes it really easy for schools to manage tens of thousands of these devices at once. So, like, if students are taking a standardized test, you know, the administrator of the Chromebooks can use software to just press a button, and those laptops are locked down during tests so students can't, like, search things online or whatever. And you see Microsoft this year announcing a similar program to manage thousands of Microsoft devices. And so you see You know, and Apple this year announced that it was going to reduce the price of its latest iPad for school customers.
Right.
So we see that they are trying to come back, and Apple just launched a coding, learn to code app for students. And we're seeing them see that that they have to, if they want to compete, develop school-specific products and features.
But Google has a nice head start. What do you see going forward for Google in the classroom at this point?
You know, one can suspect that their market share is only going to grow.
Yeah.
Because the tools are easy to use, and they've made teachers' lives easier. And students, I mean, I go to schools. I went to this public high school, Brooklyn College Academy, a couple of weeks ago, and students had a classic assignment to write a sonnet. But then they got on Google Docs, and their assignment was to edit each other's. You know, so you have this class of students sitting next to each other, sending each other comments on their things in real time, and they were really engaged, and it was super interesting to them. And at the end of the class, the teacher sent them a Google form, which is like a questionnaire, and said to the kids, like, tell me how I'm doing. And it has so changed the practice of teaching and learning that you can see that this is going to grow. I mean, and then in a few years from now, some other company might come with another system. But there's a lot of enthusiasm for these tools.
Natasha Singer, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Natasha Singer is a reporter for the New York Times. We'll have her article in the Times from over the weekend, a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. It's all about the dominance of Google in the classroom, from the colleges, universities, on down to the K-12s. More Tech Tuesday is coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Amazon is continuing its push to make Alexa the best option in the world of digital assistants. Amazon Alexa users soon will be able to send and receive calls and voice messages to anyone with an Echo speaker or the Alexa app on their phone. Joining us now to talk Amazon and other tech news is contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So this new feature, it's called Alexa Calling. How does it work?
Yeah. Well, it actually works in a couple of different ways, and each one is unique when it comes to how these connected speakers are kind of designed to function. The first is almost like an intercom system if you have more than one Alexa, you know, device in your house, mm-hmm. where you can actually use it to call, you know, maybe an upstairs, you know, Echo unit or maybe a downstairs unit or something like that. So it almost creates an in-house kind of intercom system. The other thing it allows you to do is call phones that have the Alexa app enabled, and that works two ways. So if you have the Alexa app on your phone and you are not at home, you can actually call that speaker and have, you know, have that speaker kind of ring as though it were a home phone, like a landline, and have someone at home answer it.
Well, why?
Well, I think a lot of it is just, you know, to...
It's just another portal. It's just another way.
Yeah, it's just another way of doing that. And, you know, we're reaching a point where not every home has a landline anymore.
Okay.
You know, but there are still people at home, you know, who would use that as kind of a phone service. And this actually started for Amazon, not immediately within the Echo service, but actually Echo's first partner, the first non-Echo device was called Tribi. It was a kind of a fridge-mounted Amazon Echo, and it had this kind of built-in calling service that turned out to be really popular because kids could use it to call parents just by pressing, you know, kind of the service button that was on the device. And so now Amazon has kind of built it into everything.
Russell, can I interrupt you for just a second and ask you to pull the phone away from your mouth?
Sure.
That's better. Hey, so if I use this service to call home and it pops up on, you know, my Alexa device, is it Alexa talking or is it me talking?
Oh, no, no, it's definitely your voice coming through. Now, this, you know, when the okay. call starts, it's basically like a phone call.
Okay, so it's not like she's relaying something. I call her she, whatever. And then how does this new feature pair with Amazon's new device, the Echo Show?
Well, I think that this kind of sets the groundwork for that, because Echo Show, on top of doing everything that an Amazon Echo does, is also going to have a display built in where you'll be able to see, you know, video from news feeds or, you know, things that are coming in from weather services, and also a video chat service between not only other Echo Show devices, but also phones with the Echo app that have a front-facing camera.
Is this the drop-in feature?
No.
Okay.
This is, I think Amazon is really just kind of taking this and seeing, you know, how far it can be expanded for normal daily use.
So what is the drop-in feature?
Drop-in is, I guess this one's actually a little more complicated to explain. It's basically being set up so that additional services can be quickly added.
Okay. Example?
So if Amazon decides, you know, there are now going to be four different kinds of things that are going to have the Echo service built in, and one is this weird kind of camera thing that'll you know, help you over time to take pictures of your outfits and help you, you know, kind of plan outfits over time, which is this really kind of bizarre sounding thing compared to what the other Echo things do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a set of kind of unique features that allow developers to kind of build specifically for that one device and add it just for that thing.
How do you see this type of technology? I mean, will others follow suit on Alexa calling?
Well, this has been something that has been requested not just for the Alexa service, but also for Google's Home service. You know, these speakers are becoming low enough in price that they, you know, they can be kind of inexpensively put in multiple rooms in the house. And you know, for me at least, you know, having multiple kids in the house, you know, I am certainly one of the parents that hollers up the stairs to get the kids' attention, and you know, being able to be kind of in my office and, you know, press a button to get one of their attention probably wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. It's not something I would lean on every day, I don't think, but it's, you know, kind of a nice additional thing.
We talked recently on the show about Microsoft's new push into the world of virtual reality with its mixed reality platform. They're working to get people interested in developing software for them now, right?
Yes, absolutely. This is, you know, Microsoft has been working on, you know, kind of helping developers understand the approach that they're having and how it's different from kind of the virtual reality experiences that have been had so far with Oculus and HTC. And a big way that they've been doing that over the past couple of years with the Microsoft HoloLens is doing this thing that they call the Holographic Academy. And they've actually completely rechanged that. They've redesigned it entirely, and they unveiled it at the Build conference this year. They called the Mixed Reality Academy. And I was able to sit in on one of the sessions that they had during this event. And it's essentially a three-hour developer session where they kind of teach developers to think about, you know, building things specifically for virtual reality and holograms.
Why is it important to get that third-party developer interested?
We're kind of in an app ecosystem where the third-party involvement kind of dictates the popularity of a platform. If you look at Microsoft's you know, kind of the lessons they've learned from their phone operating system that you know, basically nobody uses anymore. The biggest reason that nobody uses a Windows phone anymore is because there were no apps to support it, you know, compared to what was available on Android and iPhone and you know, other platforms. So, you know, in order to make mixed reality a thing that catches on, because they're coming in not necessarily late, but later than, you know, Oculus and HTC and Sony with PlayStation,
mm-hmm.
There's a really important push to make sure that when these headsets are available to buy around Christmas time, that a lot of the same experiences that you see on these other platforms also exist in this Windows mixed reality.
So getting that outside input is what the goal of those mixed reality academies are.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a big push to kind of educate new developers, not just existing developers, but educate new developers about how, you know, writing applications for mixed reality is a little different. But then also, you know, make it clear that it's very easy to build for these platforms. And they also seem really interested in feedback from developers who want tools to be either simplified or, you know, features added or things like that. When I was talking to the people running the program, a big change from the way Microsoft had handled things in the past was making sure that the platform was updated, you know, on an almost weekly basis based on the requests made by people using the tools every day.
When you're sitting in on a preview of their Mixed Reality Academy, is it quiet or is it noisy or what's it like?
Oh, it's a mix back and forth. You know, it's the kind of thing where, you know, the team responsible for doing the educating, you know, they're kind of on stage and they give a set of instructions and a presentation. And then there's a pretty significant quiet phase there while the developers are kind of wrapping their head around that ecosystem and these new instructions and kind of implementing it on the computer that's sitting in front of them. So they're kind of going through these test set of instructions and seeing how it works with their existing setup. And that can be a little different.
All right. So what can we expect from Microsoft's mixed reality? What, compare and contrast it to the other competition out there? They want to do what is already out there and then some?
Yeah, Microsoft wants to take this and you know, kind of make it clear that this is going to be more than just something that gets used for games, which is kind of a big part of the stigma for VR right now is that it's mostly an entertainment platform. And Microsoft started this through HoloLens, which was meant really to be more, you know, kind of a workplace accessory where, you know, you're operating with more than just, you know, a controller to play video games. But they can't, you know, they can't really survive without video games when comparing these. So I think what we'll really see over the next couple of months is a big push towards how this can also be used for games in integrating with the Xbox platform, something that I think we'll see probably in the next couple of weeks. But then really, as it gets closer to Christmas, the biggest feature that Microsoft is going to be able to have is being a lower cost than the other headsets that are available today.
Speaking of virtual reality, a big title in the world of VR gaming is set to be released for PlayStation. The name of the game is Farpoint. What's it about?
It's a kind of a stereotypical hold a gun and shoot aliens game.
Okay.
Because we needed more of that in our lives. I've been teasing, you know, my thoughts on the game for a little while now because it is, you know, kind of a stereotypical, you know, they're very immersive environment, you know, where the aliens are on this kind of advanced planet and they come at you and the ones that are trying to hurt you, you take out and then you go through this story as you learn, you know, how the humans got there in the first place. But the big thing here that makes this game different from other PlayStation games is it's the first to use Sony's new PlayStation Move controller that is actually, you know, kind of shaped more like the weapon that you're using in the game.
Uh-huh.
And the idea is almost like an arcade game where you're picking up the gun and it feels more realistic in your hand and the vibration feels more realistic as you pull the trigger.
Yeah.
That's kind of the effect that Sony is going for here, is having this kind of first-person shooter game where you're standing in your living room and you're actually kind of moving around and ducking and, you know, crawling behind things that aren't actually there in real life. But, you know, it helps to feel more real as you're doing it.
Can you play this with friends?
It's something that you can play with friends online, but not in the same house right now.
Okay. So if somebody just walks into your house and sees you crawling around, you could be playing Farpoint.
I'm sure they're going to have lots of questions either way, yeah.
Have you played it?
I have, yeah.
So do you like it?
It's a fun game. I haven't played through enough of it to see how long the game is, and that's a big challenge with VR games right now is that they're priced often at the same price point as games that you'll play for 30 and 40 hours in front of a television, but they're not often actually that long because so much more energy goes into building that kind of, you know, 360-degree environment that
right.
The games end up being shorter. and that's not always as good. But I haven't had that experience with PowerPoint yet, so I'm not sure.
Okay, all right. And cost?
It's going to be $49.99 for just the game. If you want the game and the special controller, it's going to be $79.99, and it's in stores today.
So you don't need the special controller to play the game, though, right?
No, you can play with just the normal controller, you know, kind of sitting, but it's definitely not the same experience.
I'm wondering, you know, how this is going to become a thing to have customized controllers for games to just enhance the experience.
I think that's definitely the way that virtual reality, at the very least for the next couple of months, is going.
For the next couple of months, you crack me up. Google's big developers conference starts tomorrow. Where is it, or do you even have to be there to go there?
So it's in San Francisco, and you don't have to be there. A lot of it is going to be streamed online. If you take a look at Google's Twitter page, there's a whole lot of information right now for how you can watch the main keynote that starts Wednesday. You'll be able to watch, you know, all of the announcements that come from Google. And this is the event every year where Google talks about the next big version of Android and the things that they're doing in artificial intelligence and virtual reality. There's kind of big, you know, chunks split up for each one of those things.
Are you expecting a lot of big news out of this conference?
Typically, yeah. We get a lot of information about what Google has planned for the next year, and especially when it comes to the things that, you know, Google has been doing in artificial intelligence and virtual reality, and of course, the Android operating system. There's usually a lot of really good information.
You know, speaking of Google, you know, I talked earlier about the New York Times story about Google in the classroom, and you've made references to the Google in the classroom over the years and how they've expanded their reach into the classroom. And were you aware that it was at this over 50% of U.S. students in the, you know, use Google and use Google Classroom?
There's definitely been a huge expansion for kind of individual Google services, but the classrooms, at least, you know, the classrooms that I've been invited to kind of participate in as they're showing these new features, the kids themselves are usually not using more than, you know, kind of one or two of Google's features, which is similar to what they would be using at home anyway.
Okay. You wrote that you'd like Google to focus and streamline all of its messaging apps. Of course, we're getting back to the developers conference that starts tomorrow. What's your gripe there?
Well, so this is a complaint that a lot of people have, really compared to the way Apple handles messaging. You know, if you look at that, someone who owns an iPhone or a MacBook, everything gets done through iMessage, be it text message or the kind of Wi-Fi only messaging that comes from that. It's all built into iMessage, and iMessage works on everything that Apple makes. You can use it on MacBooks and the desktop and tablets. You get that same experience everywhere, and Google doesn't have one single experience that handles everything like that. And instead, they have a bunch of individual applications that are all nice for what they do, but it ends up meaning that someone like me has five or six, you know, applications on their phone that does essentially the same thing, mm-hmm. just for different groups of people. And that ends up being very frustrating.
All right. Well, Russell Holley, thanks as always. Look forward to hearing what happens tomorrow next week.
Thanks.
That's Russell Holley, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for your calls. Thanks for your emails. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.